Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Varsity's Roundtable Talk. Today's guest is Peter Murphy Lewis, a documentary filmmaker, storyteller, and advocate who's shining a powerful spotlight on the quiet heroes of long-term care. Peter is the co-creator and co-host of People Worth Caring About, a podcast and YouTube series that tells the stories of frontline caregivers in retirement communities across the United States. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Excited to be here. Thank you.
So you've done some really fun things on camera, including hosting a TV show in Chile about various occupations. We'll get to that later, but I want to start with People Worth Caring About. Tell me a little bit about that show.
This project was born about a year and a half ago. I worked in the long-term care space since about 2020. I got recruited to work in kind of a electronic healthcare records project and started to learn about long-term care. And along that way, I became a CNA, started a podcast. And at one of the conventions, I pitched to the Nebraska Healthcare State Association leadership team. I said, why don't we take what I've done in television in South America and do a version of that in long-term care? I didn't think that they would say yes, and they did. And this, what was going to be like a 20-minute show on YouTube, ended up being a 7-part series that just got accepted on all smart televisions in the United States. So now it's grown beyond Nebraska and Jaylene Carpenter's yes to me.
That's great. And as I'd mentioned, as we were getting on, I've been watching the episodes of from Nebraska as well as Ohio. And I was wondering, what pair of glasses was Peter going to wear? And I like your selection.
It might be my seal. I probably have 20-ish glasses.
I was wondering how you keep them all organized and how you store them and dust them off and whatnot, or travel with them, I guess.
But. Well, people tell me all the time when they see me on video, Peter, why don't you pay the extra $75 to get the anti-reflection? You can see my glasses reflect, which they came out with that technology 30 years ago. But I said, when you have 20 pairs of glasses and you have to change the prescription once in a while, you have to go cheap somewhere.
That's right. That's right. That's great. I love the energy. But so of all the stories out there to be told, what made you want to do a series about senior living or long-term care?
I would say that it was a personal story that kind of started it. When I started working in the industry, I realized that caregivers were fighting against a negative perception, a negative narrative, negative reputation that started before COVID, but is accentuated during COVID by bad media. And I had had great experiences in long-term care. My grandparents moved into nursing home a couple months before I moved to South America when I was 23 years old, and I helped them. And my father had lunch with them 7 days a week, and their caregivers were spectacular. And today that nursing home is closed. It's closed because there's not margins. It's closed for many, for compliance, for regulatory, whatever the issue is. And these people that were great caregivers don't get the recognition that they deserve.
Amazing. And you know, I do know that it's a tough environment to operate a skilled nursing community. And I'm sorry to hear about that. But no, that's amazing that you're shining the spotlight on a lot of these folks who wouldn't normally have the spotlight shown on them. So you mentioned Jaylene Carpenter and you'd collaborated with her to create this series. How did the collaboration begin, and what made the partnership work so well?
It started at a social hour with the president of the foundation in Nebraska. I told Jeff, I said, hey, let's do this. Let's focus on the caregivers. And he passed it over to Jaylene at the association. And you know, she told me, she said, get me a quote and let's make this happen. And at the beginning, my employer was going to finance my time and my side of it. And our company was purchased. It was, we had an exit and that was fine, but I had already given my word to Jaylene, and I wanted to finish the project. So we went and did the project. The person who acquired us didn't want to do it. And you know, if it weren't for Jaylene's trust in me and me willing to do something that could have fallen on its face, I don't know. I don't know if we would have gotten where we are.
And you know, I'm sure it is one of those things that if you knew what the future held, you may not have gone on the path, but I'm sure you're really glad that you did go on the path.
Well, it allowed me to stay in long-term care, right? Like, you know, and that's very, very fulfilling to me.
That's great. So why was it important to focus on stories of the staff rather than the residents in these communities?
I think there's a couple different reasons. Firstly, I didn't know any different. My television show in South America is like Dirty Jobs, where Mike Rowe interviews people doing difficult jobs. So I didn't have any other format. I'm not from television. I've never taken a class of communication or marketing or television or media or anything like that in my life. So I got a TV show without knowing what I was doing. And so I just replicated the same format into caregivers. Now, looking back on it and now understanding how strategically correct it was, I guess I would say accidentally correct, is I also realized that in long-term care, people complain a lot about the owners and the business model. But if you put the caregiver at the front, nobody's going to criticize a caregiver, right? In Ohio, I interviewed a woman named Lavita who's worked for 3 decades in memory care. Well, if we interviewed her CEO, we might criticize him or her. I don't know who it is, but there's no way I could criticize Lavita.
That's a very good point. And I believe it was in one of the Ohio episodes where they referred to people who'd been there 20 years and more as platinum members or something like that. I thought that was a great way to term it.
Yeah, that was Deanne and Dyshell.
Okay, great memory. That's great. So was there a particular story or person early in the project that confirmed you were onto something powerful?
The very first day of filming Nebraska, we went to a hospice place called the Grace Space. I don't remember what episode it ends up being in the season, but it was the first day we filmed.
Interesting.
And I don't think I'd never been in a hospice. And one of the women who became the star of that episode, was nonverbal, and she had created an amazing relationship with her CNA. And CNA was probably 19 or 20 years old.
If I'm not mistaken, she was the dancer, right?
Uh-huh, she was the dancer. And yeah. And she wrote on her cell phone that how blessed she was to have him carrying, and that she was excited to go to heaven, where she was going to dance again. And that I knew that something was special, because people think of CNAs as cleaning bathrooms and changing diapers. They don't realize how beautiful it is in the relationship that you get to make with women like Kim. Her gratitude and appreciation of life will change how you think about life. And at that point, I knew that we weren't going to do a 20-minute YouTube documentary. I called Jaylene soon thereafter and I said, I think we have enough material to do 7 different documentaries. Why don't we do a season?
That's great. And I did, you know, particularly love that episode as well. And just seeing the joy on the resident's face, who was nonverbal, but as she was, you know, hearing the music and kind of reliving that in her mind. I mean, it was beautiful. So you're more than 100 episodes into the podcast, People Worth Caring About. You've traveled from Kentucky to New Mexico, and along the way, you've met some remarkable individuals. As you look back, who are some of the people that stand out? You referenced a couple of folks already, but who are some of the others that may have stood out?
In Nebraska, there was a woman that I believe was executive director of a facility called Stone Hearth, Barb. There was a lot of jokes because she's retired a couple times and she always comes back. I think that's memorable because she's so well put together. She's not a woman that you would think would never retire. And it's become her family, right? Like, she has the demeanor that she could be on a cruise ship today, or she could be in Palm Springs. And she's taken care of the grandparents in this beautiful little town. And I think what I like about stories, and this is something that I learned from Ken Burns, right? Like, stories are pretty much the only thing that can change our opinion in life. And documentaries even do it better. Documentaries can help shape a narrative. And the reasoning is, as he says, because documentaries are long enough to show the contradictions of humankind. And you and I have contradictions. We, you know, if we lined up all of our opinions and our principles and what we think about politics or religion or parenting, we have contradictions. We're not perfect.
Absolutely.
And the human, when we watch that, we know that. So when I find people who go against my stereotypes and teach me something, I really love that. Another example, and I shared this on LinkedIn a couple weeks ago, and this has kind of gone viral, at least for me, is a gentleman named Kevin, and I'm going to have him on the podcast soon. I interviewed him. It was my second to last day filming in New Mexico, and I walked into his nursing home. His nursing home publicly has a bad reputation in the sense that a lot of people criticize it, but that's because they take a lot of marginalized public that no one else would take. So they have psychiatric and abuse and unhomed. And so it's just a difficult place to operate. And I remember walking into his room with his caregiver, David, who's been a nurse there for 30 some years. And I walked in and I said, Kevin, I really like your room. You really take care of it. And he interrupted me and he said, this is my home. And I don't think, this is going to make me tear out, Dick. I don't think that I knew that in the industry we use the word home, but when we talk to people, we call it their room.
Yeah.
And that's not fair. That's not fair. Like when you come over to my house, you don't say, oh, your wife really decorated your room nicely. It's my house. Yeah. You would say, thank you for inviting me into your house. And being that open and being slapped in the face by Kevin is a big deal. Those are two.
That's beautiful. That's amazing. So a lot of people who work in senior living are doing emotionally heavy work, as you've been sharing. In your experience, how do they cope with it? How do they stay motivated and grounded?
I don't know. They're stronger than I. I think I could do it at spurts, but I think that I would emotionally be burnt out. I think that, you know, like, one of my favorite books is The Five Languages of Love. And the premise of the book is people want to be loved in the same way that they love others, or change the word, make it work environment. They want to be appreciated the way that they appreciate. And so I think the majority of people in long-term care that are direct caregivers, their love language is service, acts of service, work, doing something for someone. So I think that they just have a mechanism where they can compartmentalize and they feel fulfilled, making other people feel great through their acts of service. They just have a skill set that I don't, right? Like my love language is words of affirmation. So I could tell seniors all day long. I could tell residents all day long. I could tell caregivers how great their work is. I don't have the strength to do service all day long like they do.
That's well said. I do think it was amazing, and I forget which, I'm not going to be able to recall exactly which community, but there was one where there were two sisters that were working in activities. One was, I think, 24 and 28, and their mother and other sister worked in house. It was just interesting how, you know, at such a young age, people were finding this and finding this path for themselves. I thought that was very cool.
Yeah, there's kind of two instances about that. One of them, I think you might be referring to either Covenant Village, where the two sisters in Ohio outside of Cincinnati were recruited from Subway. And I think that they have even another family member who works there who didn't want to be on camera. And then the other version, which is in the manor at Perrysburg, that there was a resident who recruited all of her family in there. So it was a resident who brought in like four grandchildren and then a niece and then like a daughter. And I think she had five family members working there. And what a testimonial of faith or a badge of honor if the nursing home is so great that your resident brings in the caregivers, recruits.
And you know, one of the things that really struck me in watching the two series that I watched was, and somebody stated it very overtly, that so many people think of a nursing home as a place to go and just simply live out your last days, or just exist for, you know, I mean, I've heard older adults that I've interviewed refer to it as God's waiting room, but there is a lot of life happening, and I've certainly witnessed it, but it came through loud and clear in your documentaries. I mean, the couple that got married and recruited two of the nurses to be I think they call them the man of honor, and then the best man as well. That was a great story.
Yeah, that was June. That was a really, really beautiful story. And you know, it goes, that's another example, like going back to the story about Kevin, right? Like, they teach us something. You and I, if we haven't met these caregivers or we haven't met Happy Residents, you and I might think it's the place where you go to die. And then you see this story where these two fall in love and that their two best friends are their caregivers, their nurses. I love being forced to learn something that corrects, you know, where I was wrong.
Sure, sure. So were there moments that completely shifted your understanding of aging or caring for older adults? I know that you said you had started in that, you know, at a young age, but was there anything through this that really shifted that?
Or enhanced? Yeah. I think there's two that come to light. One of them's very emotional and one of them's a lot of laughs. I filmed at a cool location outside of Cleveland called Singleton. And it was predominantly African-American nursing home. It was been in the family, I think, for three generations. It was an old, old mansion. And I danced. We sang karaoke. There was a gentleman who picked up the microphone, and his stage name, I don't know his real name, is Mississippi Jackson. And I broke down. I tried to break it down for a white boy dancing. And I didn't think you dance in nursing homes. I mean, I'm from Kansas. I've danced more in a nursing home in the last 12 months than I've danced in the entire state of Kansas. Right?
That
has a lot to do with aging, right?
Absolutely.
I hung out with a bunch of people that were 70, 80, 90 years old and danced with them, but I'm 45 and live in Kansas and I haven't danced. And then the other episode is in New Mexico that comes out in a couple weeks. I filmed in this beautiful location called Red Rocks, about 2 or 3 hours west of Albuquerque. And I worked with a bunch of caregivers who are Navajo and take care of about 50% of their residents are Navajo. And they speak to them. They do their activities in Navajo. And what was really, really cool about it is there is a Filipino therapy worker who started to learn Navajo, and she said she wouldn't work anywhere else. That also goes against what I think about aging, right? Like, my stereotype before I walked in there would say, as you get older and you move into a nursing home, you're not going to be able to have what you had when you were at home. You're not going to be able to listen to the music you want. You're not going to be able to keep the air conditioning the way you want or the foods. Well, at this place, not only can you have the way you want, you can speak in your native language for somebody who didn't know it 10 years ago.
That's amazing. And I did find it interesting in one of the episodes for A Boy from Kansas, how you, without even thinking, broke into Spanish. I think one of your producers or somebody on your team said, you're speaking in Spanish.
I think that's happened a couple times.
That's great. So what kind of reactions have you heard from long-term care professionals watching the series?
Oh, the feedback's been really, really special. From thought leaders, you know, I've heard from the president of the board of American Healthcare Association about how special it was. He went to the premiere, Phil Scalo, and went to the premiere in Nebraska and just told me that it was a great, authentic depiction. From non-thought leaders, right? Like, I was at LTC 100 convention in Florida in May, and this woman came over to me. And she said, I can't believe you're here. And she gave me a big hug. And she said, I just binge watched your entire series on the plane from California to Naples. And it was so good. I interrupted my husband, who was watching something else, and made him watch it with me. There's a lot of experience. There's a lot of stories like that that make me realize. I guess the one that's closest to heart is my father. When he watched it at the premiere in Nebraska, he hugged me and we were both crying afterwards. And he said, this is one of the most amazing, one of the proudest moments of his entire life. And as a father, you know, me being proud of my son, I can understand what that means when it comes from his mouth.
That's wonderful and certainly well-deserved from what I've seen. That's great. So And I know this might be a hard question, but if you could show one episode to someone outside the field to change their perception of long-term care work, or just the perception of long-term care, which one would it be?
Probably the Grace Space, the with the hospice, and Kim, and Chance, just because it had so much impact on me. It just breaks down so many stereotypes, and the fact that he's so young helps in multiple ways, right? If one of the reasons we create is we want to help out with the staffing shortage. As it grew, we realized that we were going to help change the public perception, but that wasn't the first goal. If we can get more young high schoolers to look up to somebody like him, I think the world would be a better place.
That's a great point. And again, I'm not going to get the line right. I was thinking I should have had a pen and tablet when I was watching, but there was one where there was a group of, I believe it was high school students, maybe it was a some sort of a sports team that were helping residents pot plants. And you had a line, something about, you know, it was a great excuse for young hands and old hands to touch or something like that. And I just thought that was a really poignant moment and a way to kind of think about intergenerational, multi-generational interactions.
Yeah, that was at Good Samaritan in Auburn, Nebraska. And, you know, they had probably 20 high schoolers come in and plant pots on plants with the seniors and the residents. And that was beautiful because I think, you know, for those of us that are older than COVID, like you and I grew up going to nursing homes to do volunteer activities. My parents took me there. My school took me there. My church took me there. But COVID interrupted that flow of being a volunteer for many, many generations. And once you get out of the routine, you might not do it again. Sure. And showing that that still happens might be an inspiration to show a parent, oh, you know what? That did me well. Why don't I take my teenager to do it?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's great. I'd also love to just hear you talk a little bit about, there were the two different, I think one was Nebraska, one was Ohio. One, a woman was making a cake making brownies, I think. And you know, you were helping to blend it and whatnot. And then the other one was a gentleman who was developmentally disabled was helping make like little pizza things. And the patience that the activities people, caregivers, you know, whatever their exact role was remarkable. And I think you had said it, that it would be easier just to do it themselves rather than help the resident do it and have that experience of doing it. I just thought that was really, really impactful. But talk a little about those two situations, if you wouldn't mind.
I learned about that as well. So, you know, when I became a CNA, I was taught in theory that you need, the best way that you can help a resident is by giving them full autonomy, not just autonomy about their rights, but physical autonomy. You're going to improve the quality of their life if you don't do things for them. Rather, you help them do it for themselves and to their greatest capacity. And those were good examples, right? Mirna, unfortunately, we just lost Mirna in the last month. And she was, you know, she was the president of her community. And she had that relationship with the caregiver who was teaching her autonomy, and Mirna understood it. And, you know, that trickles all the way down to all of the other residents. The other example that you give, you know, that was at I can't remember the exact word. It's a place for those with disabilities. And it's for kids over 18. It was like a boys' dorm. I think there was about 8 residents, and we worked with Jared, and his caregiver, Christy, and that was just, and Carissa. And that was cool because I didn't know those places existed.
Yeah, me either.
I didn't know how they're created. I didn't know that there's 3 people who take care of 8 people so that they can have the quality of life that I have, even though that they have much different disabilities or differing abilities is what I learned from somebody. They're not disabilities, Peter. They're different abilities. Those were cool. Jared came to the premiere in Ohio with his parents. And when he came into the theater, he came up on his wheelchair, and he looked at me and he said, "You're coming to see my movie?"
That's great. That's great. And I think it was in the behind the scenes episode where, you know, he was all excited once he saw himself on camera, but I bet that was a cool experience for, for them, not just living their lives, but being a part of this.
Yeah, the actual execution of filming is fun because, you know, you probably get this as a podcast host and a content guy and a media guy. Not everybody lives in this world. So there are some things that are the part of the execution that is pretty joyous for the participants. And it's, you know, you and I get to live through that again to see their joy. And you put a camera in front of somebody who doesn't feel like they've been listened to or understood, and you give them a platform, that's rewarding.
That's wonderful. And I guess I'm curious. So how did you approach consent and trust when filming people in such, intimate emotional settings?
I think that was my biggest concern starting off the project because, doing a version of Dirty Jobs in South America is different. I was interviewing 30-year-olds, 50-year-olds, 70-year-olds, working professionals who want to be on TV. But when you go into a nursing home, first of all, you're working with caregivers who don't feel comfortable in front of cameras, right? These aren't people who brag about what they do on TikTok. These are people who clean our grandparents and our parents and me at some point. These are humble people who work hard doing dignity in the darkness. So I didn't know if that was going to result. I thought that I might walk into a bunch of shy people. And then lastly, how do you show aging generation, how do you show elders that they are going to and put them in a light that's honest, that's not Hollywood, that's human, but is also fair? And that was a concern. So that was my biggest concern. With consent, our partners that we film with, the state associations, and now we have five coming on, five different seasons.
Oh, that's great.
They help us do that. So they reach out, they find the caregivers, we interview them, we select them, my director selects them. And then anyone who doesn't want to be on camera, we put like a post-it note on their shirt. So when we're walking around with cameras, we're like, oh, there's a post-it note, Derek doesn't want to be on, and we just move the camera. But you'd be surprised the amount of people who don't sign the consent before we come in. And then we see how much fun it is and, how we're telling people stories, and then they sign the consent.
That's great. And I think there was at least one situation that you alluded to in the series where you had to make a last minute change.
Yeah, that was the one of the two sisters who were recruited from Subway. So we were headed to this beautiful hospice facility in Ohio, and they had a COVID outbreak, and we had to do a 180 and go back to Cincinnati. But because of that, circumstance, we also got to meet these two young sisters that show a face of a younger generation, which is what we need right now.
Absolutely. That's great. So did you notice any regional or cultural differences in how long-term care is delivered across the states? I mean, I know Nebraska and Ohio are upper Midwest, however you want to term it, but you mentioned New Mexico, and you said there are two other states that you're going to be launching?
Yeah, Kentucky will be filming. Kentucky and North Dakota will be filming next year, and we have a slot for one more state. New Mexico was the biggest change for me. I myself, having lived in South America for almost 15 years, my wife is from South America. We speak Spanish at home with our son, so we have a lot of Latino customs inside of my house. We hug everybody when they come in. There's no time for you to go home when you come to our house, type of thing. I thought that I would understand the culture in New Mexico maybe more than I did. There was a lot of learning there, right? They have a lot of indigenous culture. They have a lot of Hispanic, Latino culture. And I think that was unique for me. I listened a lot more to try to pick up on those than I might have had to in Nebraska.
Interesting. Interesting. So you mentioned you're going to North Dakota.
Yeah, yeah. We expect to be filming there in September 2026.
Okay. I grew up there, and my father lived in the last 10 years of his life in an assisted living community and then a skilled nursing community for about a year before he passed. So I'll be curious to see which ones are on your roster. That's great.
Maybe you have to send me the short list if you recommend them.
Will do. So I'm sure there were, but were there moments that you had to stop filming just to be human and present with either the caregiver or the resident?
Multiple times, mostly because of tears. Mm-hmm. The episode that I mentioned Red Rocks with the Navajo population, there was a moment that we were doing an interview with one of the caregivers in one of the kind of indigenous homes that are built there. They build it inside of the facility so they could remember the homes that the Navajo would have been born in and lived in and gone to school in. And we were having the chat, and I couldn't get through the interview. She and I started crying so hard. We just held each other's hands, and I bet you that there were 2.5 minutes of silence other than our sobbing, where the camera guy was crying too, but he couldn't put down the camera because there's a chance she and I started talking again. The director was crying. The executive director of the state association was there. It was five of us just bawling, hearing how beautiful why she goes there. Almost everything has been because of tears. There's one instance where we had to quit filming because it was so cold. We were filming an interview in Cleveland after I'd been at a facility. I think it was the day that we filmed at the beautiful African-American Singleton. And we were filming outside in downtown. It just got so cold. My body quit working. My hands quit working. I think it's in the after and behind the scenes because I start fighting with the cameraman. They're throwing snowballs at each other. And I'm completely frozen on this bench.
That's great. I love that. You had to have a little fun with it too, right?
Yeah.
So this is a question that I ask every Roundtable Talk guest. What are you looking forward to as you age? You still have a lot of life to live, but what are you looking forward to?
Wish you could tell me the best answers you've heard. Give me a cheat sheet. Send me something over. I guess I feel like I'm kind of there in the sense that about a year and a half ago, I asked my parents if they would relocate from Kansas City area over to where I live in Wichita, which is about 3 hours. And it was just far enough that I didn't see them very often. I have a small 2-bedroom home. So when they would come, they would feel comfortable. They would, you know, we'd give them our bedroom and they felt out of place. We would go there, traveling with a small kid, 3 hours on a Friday and then 3 hours back on a Sunday, wasn't comfortable. And I asked them to relocate, and they did a year ago, and they live less than a mile away from me. And I see them 6 days a week. They come over for dinner,
That's great.
And then the sixth day they come over for a glass of wine, and they take food home to their house. My wife cooks for them. And I say that's what I look forward to. I look forward to aging, being next to my parents as long as I can. And then if my son wants to be around me, I think my wife and I are just going to follow him everywhere we can, until he says, get out of our life. So I think aging with my wife and my son.
That's great. There's no right or wrong answer, but I do love that. And I've done that drive a few times. We have a client, Kingswood in Kansas City, and a client, Larksfield Place in Wichita, both very good organizations. So, I've gotten to know both areas. So, shifting here, please don't laugh at my Spanish, but you spent some time in Chile where you hosted a TV show called Aquí te las traigo, Peter.
That's almost perfect.
Was it? I have to admit, Dave Schaffner, our producer, spelled it out phonetically here for
okay.
me. But so roughly translated, it means here they are, Peter. In the show, you travel around Chile, spending a day in the life of various occupations. You sold ice cream, you're a glass blower, a carnival performer, and in one emotional episode, you were even a grave digger. How did immersing yourself in everyday labor shape your empathy and curiosity as a storyteller?
I think it transformed me. It definitely refined my communication skills. Most directly, I would say that it taught me that curiosity is not just part of my personality. Rather, it's an attribute that I should strive for and that humans should strive for. And it's not just an attribute that you should have when you're on television. Rather, it's a good quality to have anywhere. And I would say that I thought I was always a good listener. But working in television and immersing myself taught me to be a better listener and to ask more questions. I think in the Western culture, from about the age of 15 on, we teach our youth, and then this becomes cemented as we become older, that asking questions shows that you lack knowledge, aka you're stupid. So, you know, like if you're 16 and you ask a question in high school, people are going to make fun of you. If you're 8, they won't. And if you're 20, it's worse, right? Like, have you, have you ever been at a cocktail party or social and, you know, someone says an acronym that you should know, or everyone thinks you should know, or they say something about politics and you don't know it or something. And then everyone looks and they say, you don't know, right? Like, why do we shut people up so that they no longer ask questions? It's a fault of ours. And being able to get rid of that off of my back, which I was forced to do by television, helped me. I think it made me a better father.
Sure, sure. That's great. And how did you end up in Chile?
I won a scholarship from Rotary Club to study my master's anywhere I wanted in the world, back when I got out of undergrad in Boston. And that's, I chose that I wanted to be in South America. I loved Spanish, and that it was a perfect place. And I lived there for 7 years and then met my wife 7 years in, and she talked me into having a son, and here we are.
That's great. And you brought her back to Kansas.
Yeah. We go back to Chile almost every year on Thanksgiving, and we stay there for 4 to 8 weeks every year.
Oh, that's great. So I want to ask you a series of rapid fire questions about some of the jobs that you experienced on that show. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
What was the most physically demanding job?
Manual labor inside of a mine. There's a person who used a pickaxe. Oh, it's horrible.
So just the classic old, like we would think it's,
oh, yeah.
It's right there.
Oh, like a movie from the 1900s.
Wow. Did you have one of those, I'm not trying to, you know, demean it, but did you have one of those little like flashlights on your, your helmet?
It was during the day and it was an outside mine.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. What was the most emotionally demanding job?
The very first thing that I ever filmed, the very first day, and you already mentioned it, it was the Grave Digger in South America. I know this is a fast answer, but I'll give this peek because it's interesting. In South America, you have to pay dues to take care of someone's grave. If somebody in your family quits paying those dues after you've been buried, they dig you up and put you in a common grave. I dug up a woman that was 82 years old and moved her to a common grave. And I connected with my grandmother who'd recently passed.
That is amazing. And no, I love to hear some of the color commentary on that, but, kind of a hard transition from that, but what job made you laugh the most?
Stand-up comedian, because I was horrible at it. So I, you know, when you laugh at yourself because you're nervous, that was that day.
Sure. Did people in the, audience laugh? Did they enjoy it?
I did okay. I would say that I start off the day as an F comedian. And after about 6 hours of training with a professional, I would say that I got to a B+. It's hard because people pay for you to make them laugh and they're intoxicated. So they're a little bit, and like I could make you laugh like I just did then, but you're not paying me. You didn't show up to a comedy show. Imagine if you paid $30 and now you sit back and want me to entertain you. That's a lot harder.
Absolutely. Now, I do have to ask, I know that you said that you liked Spanish before you went down to South America. Were you I assume you were fluent to some degree, but I would imagine in comedy, you have to know some of the, the ins and outs of the language, the local dialect, how to make a joke in that language, which I think could be really hard.
Yeah, I would say that was probably my advantage, because being kind of a sociologist and a good listener, I pick up on weird cultural idiosyncrasies. And I think that was my only saving grace. It definitely wasn't my accent.
That's great. So what job scared you the most?
Cleaning windows on a skyscraper. And just last week, one of those guys who cleaned a window fell and died from that hospital building.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I can only imagine. I guess I always like to think that there are enough, even though it looks scary, there are enough safety precautions, but wow, sorry to hear that. If you had to actually do one of those jobs for an entire year, which would you choose?
I'm going to cheat. I'm going to say a CNA. I love being with caregivers. I don't think I could do it for a long term, but I could do it for a year.
Sure, sure. Just to build on that one, you were in a lot of different types of communities, from a hospice house to, helping people who are developmentally disabled to skilled nursing, et cetera. Is there memory support? Is there one of those types of communities, and you have to identify which one, mm-hmm. by name, but a type that you would like to work in for a year?
I think hospice first, and then because when I worked as an HIV AIDS caseworker, I had clients who passed, and I found that very fulfilling. The second option would be I worked in an assisted living that has a Montessori school connected to it, and the kids move back and forth, and that intergenerational learning is really, really cool.
That's wonderful. So if there was a blooper reel, what would be the funniest clip, do you think? Aside from maybe the snowball fight that you were talking about earlier.
I'll go back to the TV show. This is easy to remember. I was filming a gentleman who does an old tradition of making kind of like farmer sandals, like rustic sandals that you would wear when you're doing a harvest. They make them out of semi-truck tires. So imagine taking like a razor blade and cutting off pieces of rubber and then putting that into ways that you could give that to poor people who couldn't afford shoes. And this gentleman still does it, still sells them. While we were interviewing him, I asked him how he got a big cut up here. He said that he got in a fight. And I asked him, did you win? And he said, I killed him. And my director got so nervous, she didn't know what to do. And she immediately cut it off. And she called the TV station to see if we could show somebody who had committed homicide. And he'd gotten to jail and he'd done his sentence. So they passed it. But that was a blooper because I was just going to keep going. I didn't know what else to do, but they cut it off.
Sure. And when you first said that, I thought, you know, he was maybe, you know, hyperbole or something, you know, that he was, wow. That would be a tough one to, you know, to kind of think through, but good for you for barreling forward, at least wanting to. So like I mentioned earlier, you've done more than 100 episodes of People Worth Caring About. Hopefully we'll see 100 more. What you'd mentioned with the, you know, the video series, you're going to Kentucky, New Mexico, and North Dakota, I believe you'd said. How is it evolving? Or, I mean, it's a pretty sound format, but how are you seeing it evolve? And then the podcast as well.
I kind of see it as a domino effect. Ohio, I think, sent me a direct message on LinkedIn after they saw it. New Mexico was, I just sent an email and they replied and said, yeah, we've seen it. We're interested. And it's kind of started to grow like that. And, you know, some of the thought leaders in the long-term care industry who've given us space to talk about it. LTC 100, Senior Living 100. This year I'm going to 10 different conventions to talk about it. It's just kind of moving and moving and moving. So, you know, my dream is to do it in all 50 states. I don't know if we'll get there, but I didn't think I'd get to 5.
Hey, that's great. You're 1/10 of the way there. So how can storytelling like yours be used more effectively to influence policy or public support for caregivers? You know, not to get political, there's obviously a lot in the public discourse right now, but how can it be used to influence policy?
Yeah, so I've heard from my partners, the state associations, how they've used it. One of them uses it with geofencing ads around the U.S. Capitol. So they're showing clips of it. When they can't get the representatives, they can't get our politicians to come into a nursing home, they can show them a 15-minute clip. And they're already doing that. And that's been very successful. So lobbyists and leaders have been able to do that. When we were in Ohio, some of the most important people from the Department of Health came to our premiere and said how special it was, right? Those are people sometimes that don't always understand the hard work that it is or what are the margins or the staffing problems. And so, and then the last one, I have one of the partners uses it for fundraising. So they can show, you know, sometimes inside of your foundations, you don't have something tangible for the initiatives that you're working on. You know, invest in this idea, invest in this project, in this initiative. This is something tangible that they can show that helps with their membership, but also shows with their initiative.
That's great. So what advice would you give to someone who wants to enter the space as a documentarian or an advocate?
I think I would lower the standard a little bit. I think I would say, just get out your cell phone. Don't worry about a camera or a microphone and find a story that you think is interesting and just start to document it. Make it 10 minutes. You know, long form storytelling doesn't have to be 60 minutes. It has to be long enough that it shows the contradictions of who we are as humans, because when a viewer hears and sees the contradictions, we trust it. We know that the world is not perfect. We don't expect long-term care to be polished. So I would say, just start by filming something and then show it to someone else? And does it resonate? Does it make them want to be a caregiver? Does it want to make them talk to a resident? So that would be the starting point in long-term care. To take it up to your direct question, documentarian, I think I would probably find the topic that you are most passionate about. Go find somebody else who is a decision maker and is passionate about it and pitch them on the idea. Share an episode of this with them and say, hey, I want to do this in your industry or in your city or in your town.
I love that. So last question. What have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self? It seems like, you know, you're a guy who is on a path. You see an opportunity. You go for it. I love that, you know, the carpe diem. But what do you wish you could have told your younger self?
The first thing that comes to mind is pretty superficial, which is, Peter, you're not going to want to be an academic. I did my master's and then I almost finished my PhD and I was a full-time professor and I dedicated almost my entire life up till the age of 30 to academia. And today I don't use many of those. So
pivot sooner.
Yeah, pivot sooner. I think I was probably chasing some false accolades that I thought were important to my parents, but they actually aren't. They encouraged me to quit my PhD when I got sick and was hospitalized. A little bit deeper, I would say, don't be afraid of being a father. Because of some trauma in my life, I didn't want to be a father. The reason that I partnered up with my wife now is because she didn't want to have kids. And then she talked me into having kids and it's just, for me, it's been a life changer. So his name is Quentin. If I could have had, you know, 7 Quentins and started when I was 20, I think that I would have been a fine father.
That's great. That's great. Well, Peter, thank you so much for your time. And I have to say I've, over the years that I've been in this career, I've led focus groups. I've talked to so many, team members in communities and residents in communities. But boy, did I learn a lot, and it really touched my heart watching your documentaries. So thank you for everything you're doing for the field.
Thank you for your kind words and sharing this on your platform.
Absolutely. And thanks also to Dave Schaffner, our producer, and Matt Campbell, our engineer. Peter, have a great rest of the day.
Likewise.